and Norm Shealy. Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us, I hope I say your name right, Dr. Bridget Bongardt, and we're going to talk about polycystic ovarian syndrome, among other things, and about Dr. Andrew Weil's conference that'll be coming up pretty soon here in Atlanta. So how are you, Dr. Bongardt?
Great, Eva. Thank you so much for having me.
Did I say your name right?
You're perfect.
Oh, good. So before we get started, why don't you take a few minutes to tell us about you, where to find you, how you came to do what you're doing, and, of course, Dr. Weil's conference that's coming up pretty soon in Atlanta.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Well, I'm Bridget Bongardt. I'm a board-certified internist in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I've been practicing internal medicine for about 20 years. And I thought to myself, you know, we're doing a great job with Western medicine, but there's really more. What do you do when people hit the wall? How do you prevent disease? How do you help the person make a shift into wellness and wholeness? And so in our medical training, we also didn't get a lot of emphasis on nutrition. And I was very fortunate to find the program in integrated medicine, as it was called at that time. Now it's called the Arizona Center for Integrated Medicine. And we did a two-year fellowship, over 1,000 hours, 3 residential weeks, and it really, truly transformed the way I practice medicine and made a big difference for my patients and also myself as I changed my own lifestyle habits into more healthy ones and feel 10 times better for it. And now I'm able to teach patients how to really help themselves, sort of heal from the inside out. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than
That's
having
me.
Things done to them, actually giving them the tools to help them heal themselves. So the program is just terrific. It takes physicians, physician's assistants, nurses, nurse practitioners, and over 528 have gone through the program at this time, including 39 internationally. So it really is a fantastic program, and it's very diverse. We have now residency programs in integrative medicine. Particularly, we have 8 family practice residencies in the country. We have an integrative oncology program. We have a rheumatology chair position. We have corporate health initiatives. We do grand rounds. They have a clinic in Arizona. They do research and hold workshops, and one of which, fortunately, is going to be in your city. And that's the nutritional conference. It's the 7th annual one. It'll be at the Omni Hotel in Atlanta, May the 10th through the 12th. And Andy will be there along with a lot of other visionary people in nutrition looking at the first evening. We'll be looking at really the national impact of different things, all the way from farming to chemicals to how you can impact better nutrition in your community, family. It really is just a think tank. And I believe the public is invited to that as well as to the rest of the conference.
Now, how would somebody find out about it?
They can go to www.nhconference.org.
So the letter N, the letter H, conference.org.
Uh-huh, like New Hampshire.
Okay. All right. Now, when you say integrative, I know what the conventional side is. What I would like to raise awareness here is, what would a physician learn by coming? What is the other side of it?
Right. I love to really clarify at this point that integrative is not alternative. Alternative means you do this and you don't do that. And what we do is actually weave in evidence-based modalities that are complementary. So we look at things like massage, we look at oriental medicine, we use herbs and nutritional supplements, energy medicine, mind-body techniques like hypnosis, guided visualization, helping people to shift their awareness and consciousness, which I love your radio station here. And we actually teach people to do all that to get better outcomes in health and wholeness.
Now, I want to ask you this question. Why do you say that's not alternative? What is alternative to you?
Alternative would mean, or standardly, at least to a medical practitioner in the medical community, it would mean that, for instance, if you had cancer, you would use other practices rather than. It's a rather than thing. So
okay.
It's not alternative. So in other words, you know, you would go take shark cartilage or some unfounded thing like that, and instead of taking chemotherapy. And in integrative, what we would do is we would say, okay, oh my goodness, this is what you have, but how can we make your body and your soul and your spirit pull together and stimulate the healing process so that while you're undergoing chemo, RT, or whatever is deemed necessary, that you can, your body can really heal and impact the tumor more effectively.
Do you treat cancer patients?
I am not an oncologist,
okay.
But what I do is the oncologist will frequently send them to me to use these other modalities to help them heal faster.
Okay. Because that just raised a question to me. I wasn't planning on asking this question, but I'm going to now.
Mm-hmm.
When you do things like chemotherapy or radiation, you know, it kills everything, lowers your immune system. So how do the two go hand in hand?
Okay, well, let me just back up a little bit that chemotherapy and RT, radiation therapy, are designed to kill rapidly growing cells. So fortunately, it doesn't kill all cells, it kills the whole person. But you are right in that more than tumor cells do become effective, particularly those that are rapidly dividing, such as the hair follicles, people lose hair, the GI tract, people might get mouth ulcers or stomach problems or diarrhea. You're exactly right about that. So what we do is we try and shore up their nutrition because they a lot of times will lose appetite. And we also, that's where, again, mind-body techniques, relaxation, guided visualization, energy medicine, as well as supplements make a big difference for these people.
Okay. All right, now we'll move to your area of expertise, if that's okay. What is polycystic ovarian syndrome?
Well, polycystic ovarian syndrome is an unfortunate genetic problem whereby the person has three criteria. They have to meet two out of three criteria for this. They either have problems with ovulation, they have spotty or skipped periods, they have androgen excess, which means they have excess hair or excess acne, or they have an abnormality of their ovary where they have more follicles and or the ovary is larger than normal. And when you put those things together, those are the Rotterdam criteria for polycystic ovary syndrome. So basically these women come in with obesity, hirsutism, and irregular menses. Now, not all polycystic ovary patients have to be obese. Only 50% of them are, which means that you can still see thin women coming in that aren't menstruating regularly and have some excess hair on their lip or up their tummy. And it's very distressing, and their periods are irregular, so they're worried about becoming pregnant, or worse yet, they're trying to get pregnant and are infertile and are trying to understand why. So you have to be sure and rule out other things like Cushing's or congenital adrenal hyperplasia or some of the other medical things that can sort of mimic that. And when those are out of the way, then it's probably polycystic ovary syndrome. And you see it running in families, so there is a genetic predisposition to it. The problem with PCOS, though, it's not just an inconvenience. They're probably one of the most underreported population of women with cardiovascular risk. And so it's critical that we screen these women that we identify this and try and reverse the lipid abnormalities so they don't become hypertensive, diabetic, and have metabolic X syndrome, which is the real problem here in the way of development of disease.
When does it usually start showing up?
Well, actually, you can see it in delayed menses, 16, 17, 18 years old. These women just won't start menstruating. Most women are cycling pretty regularly by age 16, and these ladies don't. And so you become innately suspicious when they start putting on weight, central obesity, their arms and legs are thin, and they're putting it all around the midsection.
Mm-hmm.
And then they start sprouting hairs, they have increased acne, and it's very distressing for them.
I'm sure it is. Now, is an occasional ovarian cyst the same thing, or is it an indication that you have the tendency for it?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Back in the day, the person who diagnosed this, or actually who described this, is called two guys named Stein and Leventhal. And what they found was that there were large polycystic ovaries, so multiple large cysts. But those people are actually less than 12% of all the patients that present with polycystic ovary syndrome. Most actually have small shrunken ovaries or fibrotic ovaries with what we call a string of pearls. If we were to do an ultrasound, it would just look like these little ovarian follicles lining the ovaries like a string of pearls. So just because you have one cyst, fortunately, that doesn't indicate that you have polycystic ovary syndrome. It really is the whole triad of the hyperandrogenemia, the androgen excess testosterone, over 54, or free testosterone over 9.2. Those are the levels that we look for. And if you want to do an ultrasound, you can, but most of it just go on the stigmata that present.
What is the difference between a fibroid and a cyst?
Okay, great question. A fibroid is in the uterus, and it is where the myometrium, which is the muscular layer of the uterus, what we say hypertrophies or thickens or grows. And the polycystic ovary piece usually has an intact uterus, although they can have fibroids, and there is an increased risk of fibroids with this polycystic ovary syndrome. But the main problem is in the ovary.
When it hurts, does it hurt on one side or the other? Does it hurt in the middle? I mean, how can you kind of distinguish between whether it's your ovary hurting or the uterus hurting?
Okay. All right. Well, ordinarily, people with polycystic ovary syndrome don't have any abdominal pain at all. They just...
Interesting.
It's silent. People with ovarian cysts that you're thinking of don't necessarily have polycystic ovary syndrome. What they have, they may just have an enlarged ovarian cyst that's benign, or they could have an ovarian problem like what we call an endometrioma, where they sort of menstruate backwards and get the lining of the uterus implanted in and around the abdomen. And that can cause a lot of menstrual pain, and it can be on one side or the other. Uterine fibroids actually are silent to a large degree. They cause problems with bleeding and cramping.
Okay.
So women can have a lot of excessive bleeding. And if the fibroids get large enough, then they can press on structures in the pelvis, such as the bladder, such as the bowel. And they can be so large, you can actually feel them when you palpate through the abdominal wall.
Interesting.
Yeah, so they cause pelvic heaviness, and, they're a nuisance.
So... help me understand, what is the physiologic connection between polycystic ovarian syndrome and diabetes or metabolic syndrome and heart disease? Is there excess hormone being created,
yeah,
or what's happening there?
Well,
is that happening?
The whole thing is really fascinating. We're not sure. Well, there's no one specific thing that triggers it. But like everything else in the body, it is integrally linked, okay? What we find is that these women have elevated levels of insulin in response to blood sugar, and that the insulin that they produce doesn't work well. They are insulin resistant. So that means that when they eat a sugary food, the insulin level goes up high, but it's not cleared from the bloodstream. It's not taken up by the cell. And so you develop higher levels. The pancreas keeps making more and more insulin, but yet the body's resistant to it. And this hyperinsulinemia is the thing that really is the villain, so to speak. Hyperinsulinemia increases ovarian production of androgens, which are male hormones. It increases or it stimulates the pituitary to put out ACTH, which is adrenocorticotropic hormone, which then goes and stimulates the adrenal glands to put out more androgens and more cortisol. And as you well know, cortisol gives you that central obesity and increased fat. And then it also stimulates the pituitary to put out LH, which is luteinizing hormone. Luteinizing hormone should only peak in mid-cycle, which allows us to rupture an egg, and the egg can travel down and become fertile. But if you have high levels and chronic levels of LH, or luteinizing hormone, then you will not ovulate. So that's why these women don't get periods, and they become infertile.
Interesting.
And yet, it is fascinating. And then the other problem is that these elevated insulin levels also decrease levels of what's called adiponectin, which is a hormone that actually works on the fat cells and increases the amount of obesity.
So is this in any way connected with the thyroid?
No, it's not. Fortunately, that's one gland that probably isn't affected. Although, you know what? We do have a lot of people that come in and with polycystic ovary and think, oh, I've got something wrong with my thyroid. You know, I'm getting bigger, I'm getting a little more acne, or I'm tired, and da-da-da-da-da. And it's actually not the thyroid.
Interesting.
So that would be something we would want to check, of course.
So when you treat the obesity and the lipids, do you treat them individually, or do you treat them as a whole? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And it turns out that when you treat one, you treat the other. So that, for instance, if I have a weight reduction for my patient of even a small amount as 10%, you can lower the problems with fertility. You can help them cycle. You can lower their lipid levels, and you can also lower inflammation in the body. So it really is amazing. Just a modest weight loss of 10% really lowers the risk factors.
Does it have anything to do at all with estrogen dominance?
No. Now, having said that, what's interesting is that the more obesity you get, estrogen can be turned over in the fat cells, and testosterone can be turned over in the fat cells, so you wind up making more, you have more aromatase in there that makes more androgens. And then if you have excessive amounts of estrogen because you have increased body fat, then you can have, as an older woman, it can stimulate the uterus even in menopause. And so these women are at risk for development of endometrial cancer.
Do you treat them with progesterone?
Two populations here, one premenopausal, the other postmenopausal. Premenopausal, no. Postmenopausal, yes. We would use progesterone, cycling progesterone, to prevent the lining of the uterus from building up.
Mm-hmm.
And so and while we're trying to get the diet and the exercise and everything so that they get the weight reduction.
So the ratio between the estrogen and the progesterone really has nothing to do with this kind of problem.
Correct.
That's interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Really is. Okay. What is the relationship of the decreased levels of the sex hormone binding globulin have to do with this problem?
All right. Sex hormone binding globulin is made in the liver.
And tell my listeners what that is so that they may not understand what I'm talking about.
Sex hormone binding globulin is a protein that's made in the liver. And its job is to part of the body's balance to attach, it binds free testosterone. So that if you have low levels of sex hormone binding globulin, then you will have less ability to bind free testosterone circulating, which means that this you'll have more development of acne, development of terminal, what we call terminal or coarse hairs on the mustache and chin, growing up the tummy, which we call a male escutcheon. It's a pattern of hair growth on the tummy that's pretty remarkable for polycystic. And then, unfortunately, people also get, if they have the genetic predisposition, they'll get balding on the top of the head, just like male pattern balding if they get high levels of testosterone. So it really is terrible for a lady.
Can this be treated with nutrition alone?
Yes, it can.
And where would you start?
Well, it turns out there's a plethora of information about diet therapy. And it seems that the higher protein, higher fat and lower carbohydrate diets improve not only your lipid panels, but also improve fertility, improve weight loss, even without exercise. Now, let me go back to the fat piece of it. You don't want any more than 30% fat. And of that 30% fat, you only want 8% or less saturated fat, and of course you don't want trans fats because those are inflammatory, right?
Now, just for my listeners, tell us the difference between all of these.
Okay, great. Saturated fats are fats that are solid at room temperature. So we're
like lard or something.
Lard, butter, that kind of thing. Cheeses? I hate to say that. Remember, it's 8%. You get your cheese in there. But nonetheless, you want to use things like olive oil and canola and those that are monounsaturated because they cause less inflammation in the body.
Okay, I have a question here. Sorry, I just got to ask this. I interviewed Barry Sears last week, and one thing that we talked about was, well, most of the things we talked about was fats. And one of the things he preached on this show was, do not use canola oil because it's highly inflammatory. I said, well, what do we use then? He said, well, olive oil does, it doesn't do anything bad and doesn't do anything good, so it does nothing, so that's kind of safe. And I said, well, what do we use then? And he said, a smidgen of butter.
Well, I'll say this. Let me go to that point about the butter. I mean, it used to be back in the day that everybody was railing against the saturated fats, and now we know that they have some 6 omegas in there which are beneficial. The problem is that our diet is so high in 6 omegas that you don't want a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to stick with the oils basically that have high 3 omegas or that are monounsaturated, not the polyunsaturated, and not the things that, like Crisco, that when heated at high temperature make what these very tightly bound trans fats that are very, very difficult for the body to excrete and become inflammatory for the body. So that's why we make the recommendation. If he's the expert on canola, I'll give him that. I'd have to go back and look, but I remember that was one of the choices that we could offer patients. So
I always thought that was better for you too, but he was like, no, it's highly inflammatory. It's the cheapest oil that we have, he said, it and corn oil.
Well, I'll just say this. I can go back and certainly research that. But, you know, if you can stick to olive oil, walnut oil, some of those type of things that, and there's plenty of olive oil in the markets, and it's delicious.
Does it matter if it's cold pressed or not?
Those are the better ones, cold pressed extra virgin, because you get more of the polyphenols in there, which are anti-inflammatory. So
okay.
That's really the best.
Mm-hmm. Now, how does fish oil play into this?
Well, fish oil is, it actually is anti-inflammatory. It's a 3-omega fatty acid, and those actually drive the inflammatory system to the least inflammatory. So you don't drive the arachidonic acid pathway. You actually have better prostaglandin function, and so that's why we use the 3-omegas to decrease inflammation in the body.
Are you looking more for EPA or DHA when you're trying to target
that? It depends. DHA is one that we usually use for depression, for ADD, and that kind of thing. And then EPA is the other component, and that's the one we actually use for inflammation. So I recommend a good supplement that has about 450 milligrams of one and about anywhere from 500 to 600 of the other combined. And, of course, you know, if you can get the burpless variety, that's great. If you have trouble with the fish oil, then you can put it in the freezer, and it will dissolve further down the digestive tract, so you won't be burping up fish.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
He told me a little secret. He said, if you want to know if you have a good quality fish oil, you cut open some of your fish oils and squirt them in a shot glass and put them in the freezer. If it gets hard like Crisco, then you know you have what he calls sewer of the sea.
If it's creamy,
and you can, you know, stir it with a toothpick, he said, then you know you've got a good quality fish oil. I thought that was interesting.
Well, he sounds like an interesting guy. Yeah,
he really was.
Mm.
Okay, let's see. What supplements do you recommend regarding amino acids, vitamins, and minerals, and why?
Okay. Well, we actually suggest chromium because it improves glucose tolerance, it improves the way insulin functions, and actually taking about 600 milligrams of chromium can decrease your hemoglobin A1C, which is a marker of your blood sugars over a 3-month period. And it can reduce it by about 1.76%, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
And remember, this is not the only way that you're going to treat people. So all of this is just an additive benefit in addition to diet and whatever. So chromium actually decreases cortisol. It increases lean body mass. It also has a very salutary effect on the lipid profile in that it improves the HDL and improves blood pressure. So it really is a real recommended supplement. In addition, you should take biotin to that because that increases the absorption of chromium by just taking 2 milligrams of biotin daily.
I didn't realize that. Now, do you just take plain biotin, or do you take one of those B complexes that has it in there?
Well, you can do things like take brewer's yeast, so that works too.
Okay.
So I would just say take a B complex vitamin, and then you could. Mm-hmm, go ahead.
I was going to say, does it need a cofactor to work? And the both of them, the chromium and the biotin, do they need cofactors?
I'll just say that the only thing I know about the chromium is that in order to get the absorption of it, you need the biotin, but I'm unaware that it takes a cofactor. Now, vitamin D is a very interesting topic. It's a real hot topic now. And so it turns out that if you have low vitamin D levels, you have high glucose intolerance. You have high androgen production, and it impairs the biosynthesis and release of insulin. So So it's really important that you, amongst other things, take your vitamin D, at least 1,000 to 2,000 international units a day. And I recommend that everybody get vitamin D levels because I'm amazed at the amount of vitamin D deficiency or insufficiency in the practice.
Now, speaking of vitamin D, we're talking about D3, right?
Correct.
Okay. It's my understanding that that is, first of all, it's fat soluble.
Uh-huh.
And second of all, you have to take it based on your weight. So if you're, let's say you weigh 200, you're one of those obese people, you weigh 200 pounds, 150 pounds, and you take 1,000, is that going to give you enough? I take 8,000 a day, and I'm 150 or 60 pounds. So would a person that's obese, would they be getting enough to do them any good?
Well, you know, I have to confess, we don't usually we don't usually treat on weight. What we do is we usually use protocols depending on the level of deficiency or insufficiency. So
okay.
If you are anywhere between, let's say, 30 is the upper limit of, or the low limit of normal.
And 30
so
what?
30, God, is it picograms?
Oh, okay. Are you talking? We're talking about the level of vitamin D. Okay.
Yeah. So, at any rate, if you have a level of 30, 20 to 30, then we usually treat you with 2,000 international units a day. If you're below that, then we usually use the 50,000 international units and really try and stock the body up pretty rapidly. So we'll use it either once a week or once every 2 weeks, depending on how low the level is. And I've seen them down as low as 7. Particularly for people who malabsorb, meaning that they have chronic diarrhea and they can't absorb any of the fat-soluble vitamins. And so,
I think it's very interesting that people think just because they go out into the sun at all, they don't realize that they're using sunblock, they're getting not.
That's correct. And not only that, but what I thought was fascinating, I listened to Michael Hollick's lecture, who is the guru for vitamin D in the country, and he presented at the last Nutrition and Health Conference. He's absolutely dynamic. And he was saying that not only when you go out in the sun, well, what's exposed? I mean, you know, your arms
yeah.
and your lower legs and your face. And that it's really critical that you do go without sunscreen for that 15 to 30 minutes. But it may take longer than that, depending upon the latitude in the country. So, for instance, Atlanta is kind of the cutoff. Isn't that nice? But above Atlanta, you start getting increasing levels of vitamin D deficiency, i.e. the sun is at a lower slant and you get
mm-hmm.
less rays of the sun and as further up you go. Needless to say, it's also colder, so people, when they do go out, they're all bundled up or there's only a small amount of the time of the year that they can be having a large amount of surface area exposed to the sun. So it really is a problem. Then you have to worry about, you know, basal cell carcinomas and squamous cell carcinomas. That's always the other half of it. And your dermatologists are on the bandwagon to, you know, have a limited amount of sun. So I thought what I do in a practical manner is I tell my patients, look, go out in the early, you know, early morning, late afternoon. You're still getting good sun. Just avoid the noonday sun when you have such UV intensity that you're likely to burn and cause damage in the skin repair.
So let's talk about how it contributes to high blood pressure. One thing you said, or somebody said, it was you, spirulina. And the potassium
mm-hmm.
relationship, this potassium, I'm going to use me for an example. I have high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So when I take, I know that there's something to do with potassium, magnesium, and calcium. But when I take potassium supplements, it makes my blood pressure go up so high it made my nose bleed so that it shot across the room and hit the wall. So I figure there must be something in that calcium that potassium that I don't need, but taking it in spirulina, is that a different form? What form is it?
Well, the spirulina is just a blue-green algae, okay? And the reason why it works is because it is potassium laden, so it turns off the aldosterone. So now remember that these people have central obesity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have high levels of cortisol. And if you have high levels of cortisol and you also have high mineralocorticoids, which is high levels of aldosterone. And in addition to that, unfortunately, these people, when they have the low levels of adiponectin and they have increased production of lipoprotein lipase, which is another hormone that governs the fat cells, then what happens is they wind up putting out a lot of angiotensin II, which then increases the blood pressure. So to answer your question about potassium, the effect of spirulina on blood pressure was low. They think it is because it does contain a fair amount of potassium, which should then decrease the amount of aldosterone put out.
Okay.
That's what they're hoping.
That's
what they think may be the mechanism. But I'm not sure why. What else was in that potassium compound that you said? That's odd.
If you said the forms of potassium, I'd be able to tell you, but I can't think of it.
Okay. Well, it must be in something else in there because that's pretty peculiar.
Yeah, no, but it was really bad. And I thought, well, maybe it's something else and I just don't know it. So I stopped for a while, and then maybe a few months later, yeah, and I did it again, and the same thing happened. So I was like, obviously not my problem.
Yeah.
Anyway, can men have symptoms of this as well?
Good question. No, but what happens is that women that have polycystic ovary syndrome and have male children, these kids are more likely to have problems with obesity and insulin resistance even in their infancy. So it's really important that we treat these women with polycystic ovaries. And if they wind up becoming diabetic, then there's a thing called gestational diabetes, so that when the mother becomes diabetic, unfortunately the babies, be they male or female, lay down more juvenile fat cells and they become obese in utero. And then those juvenile fat cells carry with them, and it's very difficult for those kids to keep their body weight down. So it's very important that this syndrome be recognized and treated, not only for the women, but also for the children. And anyone who has the risk of who has gestational diabetes, which means diabetes during their pregnancy, glucose intolerance, insulin resistance during the pregnancy, they have a 65% chance of becoming diabetic in their lifetime.
Wow.
Yeah. So this is really a public health nuisance here. But 6.8 million women have it in our country.
What about vanadium and vanadil? I mean, should first of all, does that help? Then I'll ask you a question after you answer that.
Well, I don't know about that one. Vanadium and I think and chromium are linked, but I'd have to look at that a little bit more to be honest and answer you correctly.
Okay. I think Norm Shealy told me that vanadium, and I could be wrong about the person, but told me that vanadium kind of acted as insulin. So I was just wondering if that would be a good thing for a child to take.
Well,
if you don't know, you don't know.
We know it's one of the trace elements that's needed in the human body. So I think everyone should have a mineral supplement, surely.
Go ahead.
What I was going to say is, you talk about calcium. Calcium is required for the maturation of the egg and normal ovarian follicle development. And then you want to think about some other micronutrients. You might want to look at boron because low levels induce hyperinsulinemia in vitamin D-deprived rats. for instance. So boron may enhance vitamin D effect on polycystic ovary patients, which we already talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing about the trace elements are magnesium. And so that polycystic ovary patients have lower serum magnesium levels than normal.
How do you recommend that they take that?
I think we use 300 milligrams twice daily for insulin-resistant patients. It was is the recommendation.
Now, how do you recommend calcium with this too? Because they kind of go hand in hand.
Yes.
How much calcium do you recommend?
1,000 to 1,300.
Okay, so that would be 3 to 1, something like that?
Mm-hmm.
3 to 1 calcium to magnesium? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about probiotics? Why is probiotics recommended for treating this?
One other thing I do want to say is that but while we're on the subject is zinc. We recommend that you don't supplement with zinc in polycystic ovary syndrome patients.
Really? How come?
Because high levels of zinc have been shown to increase testosterone levels.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, so we want to avoid that.
So you don't take it at all. What if you're low?
Well, you would obviously you want to get that up to normal. Then you have to look at the copper-zinc ratio as well. So you don't want to have high copper because that robs zinc or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a real delicate balance. And most of the supplement, it would be hard unless you're just really over-supplementing with zinc.
I was going to say, how do you test for these things? Do you do intracellular tests? Do you do blood tests? How do you test for these levels?
Well, truthfully, we don't usually test for zinc. But, you know, people love to get it, love to go through the supplement rack and think, oh, you know, zinc is good for this, it's good for that, it's good for my skin, it's good for my eyes. And they'll, you know, take excessive amounts of these compounds, but whatever's in a multivitamin is fine. I think it's like 15 milligrams of zinc in a multivitamin.
And do you recommend the vitamins from the drugstore, or do you recommend that they take something? I'm looking for information about quality of the supplement you take. Does that play into what you're doing?
Well, I'll tell you this. I have two thoughts on that. Some people claim that the liquid vitamins are the best, that they're more highly absorbed. You could only absorb a certain amount of vitamins and then whatever else is excreted out in the urine. So I fall on the side of practicality. I'm sure there are vitamins that are better than others, but then you get into whose vitamin is the best, and it's endless. On the other hand, what I try and do is I try and find a vitamin that has a mineral supplement in it because people really don't get good enough nutrition. And I do think it's important that they get a mineral supplement and get the trace minerals. I do try and have them take something with beta carotene rather than straight vitamin A. I do have them try and take a B vitamin supplement because of all the stress and all the sodas and all the coffee, there's increased turnover of vitamin B6 in the body and not enough B12 because we're not eating those types of foods. So those things are necessary to decrease the stress in our life and increase your neurotransmitters. So I really suggest a multivitamin with a good mineral supplement and then probably a B vitamin complex on top is what I personally suggest for my patients.
Okay. When we were talking about these vitamins, what I really want to know is, do you laboratory vitamins versus natural plant-based vitamins? Does that make sense?
I hear you, and I fall on the side of cost, because a lot of patients, when they have multiple medical problems, can't afford expensive vitamins. So I feel that the regular vitamins that they get from their drugstore are good enough if they will eat a balanced diet. And I don't recommend that they get expensive vitamins or plant-based vitamins or anything like that.
Okay. What about probiotics?
Probiotics. This is something, though, I am very passionate about. There is increasing literature that probiotics may be the key to health. The gut, we thought, was just the, you know, the sort of the dryer and packaging unit for the body, but it turns out not. The gut is probably going to turn out to be one of the more principal regulators of the body, both in the way of nutrition, energy stores, inflammation. At least two-thirds to three-quarters of all your immune system is actually in the gut in the forms of Peyer's patches and the T cells along the lamina propria there. And the microbiota, the microflora, the intestinal organisms are more prolific and have a larger number of cells than we have cells in our body. They are actually commensal organisms, and they are in a very symbiotic relationship with the body. So if we have a good, healthy colonization of microorganisms, our body runs well. If we have taken numerous antibiotics, if we have a poor diet, then that influences the colonization, and we lose the bacteria that actually prevent inflammation and split our sugars and into the types that are non-inflammatory. In other words, whatever fuel you're ingesting, they split it into a non-inflammatory type compound that then goes across the lining of the gut. They are also responsible for the mucus layer on the gut, which is again a barrier so that you don't take foreign proteins through that lining. It's just fascinating.
Yeah, I was reading, excuse me, I had somebody contact me, that his name is Michael Gershon at Harvard. He's written this book called The Second Brain.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that the gut has more neurons than anywhere else in our body, and that without proper gut function, you can have all the serotonin in the body that you want, but without proper gut function, you're not going to be able to use that serotonin. I thought that was really interesting.
Fascinating. That's exactly right. Candace Pert, who I think won a Nobel
Prize. Yeah, I know her.
Oh, do you? Good Lord.
Yeah.
She's amazing. She was the one that first discovered that these neurotransmitters are not just in the brain. They are everywhere and all the way from the mouth to the anus. And so in addition to the effect on neurotransmitters, the important thing about the gut is that it sends, it's a constant signaling between the brain and the gut for energy metabolism, and it probably affects our obesity as well, the type of colonies that we have. So let's look at the experiment where they took germ-free mice, i.e. mice that were bred to have no intestinal flora, and then they cultured these mice or gave them back microflora from lean rats, and then another population they gave the microflora from obese rats. And those germ-free rats that got the lean flora remained lean, and those that got the obesity rat flora became obese.
Wow, that's interesting.
It is way
interesting. I haven't heard about that.
So there's a couple strands that you want to be sure that you have as take-home message. One is Bifidobacterium, and another is Lactobacillus rhamnosus. And those appear to be very salutary in decreasing the inflammation in the body and also helping to process sugars and free fatty acids. What they do is they actually have an effect on the fat cell as well as immune function, because they, the way the bacteria split the fuel is they split it into short-chain fatty acids, which are used by the adipocytes, which are your fat cells, for lipogenesis. So in other words, if you have the wrong kind of bacteria, you make more short-chain free fatty acids. They're taken up across the lining of the gut, picked up by the fat cell, and then you get increased fat cells.
Now,
fatter fat cells.
Let's talk about cons of probiotics. Is the yogurt that you get at the store enough, or do you really need to go to a health food store and get a good probiotic?
I actually recommend that you get a probiotic in capsule form. Now, some of the Greek yogurts have three or four different strands, but some of the other cultured yogurts have a single strand.
Mm-hmm.
So I prefer that my patients use a multi-strain supplement. There's also another organism in the gut that's a yeast called Saccharomyces boulardii, and that's a very, very, very important one that you won't find in yogurt, but can be wiped out with antibiotics, etc. And that also has a large impact on immune function and preserving the gut from diseases such as overgrowth of Clostridium difficile, which is an organism in the intestine that can overgrow and give people terrible diarrhea, terrible colitis.
So when they, people look at, the probiotic they're taking, they want to look at the larger the number, the better, like a billion versus 10
yes.
billion? Okay.
Yes.
People don't understand about that, I don't think.
No, you're right. You need to look at the CFU, colony-forming unit. You want to make sure that it's in the billions. And the better ones, obviously, are the refrigerated ones with the live bacterium in them. And
now,
people would worry about...
Mm-hmm. affect these things?
Yes.
So they should make sure that they don't put it with warmed food, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, I want to ask you, we talked about neurotransmitters and Candace Pert, and I just love her work, by the way, so she's one of my favorites. What have you found that any specific emotion or emotional abuse plays a role in this polycystic ovarian syndrome? For example, you know that I'm a medical intuitive, and I never knew that so many people have been touched inappropriately by caregivers until I got this ability. I started reading all these people, or that's what I call what I do, and I started making this connection. I mean, I've done it with hundreds of people, and I've realized everybody that's been touched inappropriately by a caregiver that has something to do with sex has some kind of reproductive problem, you know, endometriosis or this problem or fibroids or some kind of bleeding thing where they bleed a lot and get some kind of growth problems there. Have you found anything like that in your work? Or have you been in a position to find that out?
I have not, because I don't really look at the second chakra. You'll be talking about the second chakra, sacral chakra.
Yes.
And so a lot of people with obesity will have that. Now, clearly not everybody, you know, all the listeners out there to think, oh, Lord, I'm putting on some body fat and this is what I've got. But I do find that quite a bit. And so what I do is I actually recognize the spiritual and emotional connection behind that and start gently probing into their background. And then when I do, then I offer them things like hypnosis to help them reframe this, and also empower them to really love themselves for the first time and know that they can protect themselves. When they couldn't as a child, they can protect themselves now as an adult. And a lot of times, just doing that alone makes a huge shift for these ladies.
Mm-hmm. All right, we have about 3 or 4 minutes. You can talk about whatever you want to talk about that we haven't already. Or even if we have and you want to talk about it again. It's your time.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I would just say, if anything, I would like to add is for people to really be aware of an anti-inflammatory diet, because whether you have polycystic ovary syndrome or just live here in the U.S. and eat the traditional Western diet, we have much more inflammation in our body, so we have much more arthritis. If you have the genetic predisposition for cancer, you have increased propensity for that. If you have if you have the genetics for diabetes, you have, the inflammation just spurs it all on. So for everybody to stay healthy, I recommend that you have greater than 16 grams of fiber, you take your omega-3 fatty acids, you take your probiotics, you take a good vitamin with mineral supplement, and then you drink a moderate amount of water, because your body needs the water to have your enzymatic systems run well. And a lot of times we don't get that. And in addition to that, I think the other good health feature, whether you've got PCOS or not, is sleep. Make sure you're getting adequate and restful sleep. I don't know how many people come into the office exhausted, and the first question I ask them is, well, do you wake up refreshed? And they give me that jaded look.
So what do you recommend if, and we only have a couple minutes, but what do you recommend if they're not sleeping?
I actually like to give them, if there's no contraindication, 5-hydroxytryptophan, which is a precursor for serotonin. And I find that it just gives people great restful sleep. It's very inexpensive. 50 milligrams, you have essentially no problems with it. Getting over 100 milligrams, you take 150 or whatever, you can get some myalgias. But we stay below, we stay well below that, so 50 to 100 milligrams of 5-hydroxytryptophan. You can add magnesium at night. You can use calcium at night. Those things are very, very, very helpful for smooth muscle relaxation. And I also give them a little talk on sleep hygiene, because you wouldn't believe how many people have TVs in their room, in their bedroom.
I wish I could get off on that and ask you about EMFs and stuff like that, but we don't have any more time. So take another minute and tell us where to find you and tell us where to find information on the conference.
Okay. Information on the conference would be at www.nhconference.org. And that will be at the Omni Hotel in Atlanta, May the 10th through the 12th. And if you go the first evening, then you get to see Dr. Weil, and he's just a fountain of knowledge. And he'll probably have Katz and a few other real nutritional luminaries with him.
He's going to have Ronald Katz? Cool.
He may. He may. I haven't looked at the agenda, but I know he had him last year. And I think Willett was there, and just an amazing assortment of people.
And where can people find you?
Oh, me? I'm at Northeast Internal and Integrated Medicine, and our phone number is 704-403-7050, and I'm north of Charlotte, in a town called Concord. We're part of the CMC, Carolinas Medical Center network.
And spell your name, please, so they can make sure.
Bridget, B-R-I-D-G-E-T, and then Bongard, B-O-N-G-A-A-R-D.
Thank you so much for coming on. It was my pleasure.
Oh, great, Eva. Thank you so much.
And I can't wait to see you when you come to town.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. I'll give you a call.
All right, take care and good night.
Mm-hmm, good night. Bye-bye.